is 5:30 p.m. here at Freak Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM, www.freakradio.org. My name's the V-Man, and it is time for Rockin' the Boat. On today's show, I will be speaking with Reese Ehrlich. He is a veteran independent foreign news correspondent, the producer of a one-hour public radio special, The Struggle for Iran, hosted by Walter Cronkite, and co-author of the book Target Iraq, What the News Media Didn't Tell You. He'll be joining me today for a discussion on the U.S. making noise to possibly invade Iran. But that's coming right up after this week's Anti-Business Report. Today, Anti-Business explores privatization and government in the global economy. Argentina, India, Germany, and Kosovo. That's coming up right now on Rockin' the Boat. Stand by.
Hello, this is Anti-Business with your business report for the week of May 26th. This week, we take a look at governments and privatization in the global economy. Néstor Kirchner was inaugurated on Sunday as Argentina's sixth president in 18 months. Kirchner is the first elected president to take power since December 2001, when five leaders ruled over the course of 2 weeks as people took to the streets in protest of economic austerity measures imposed by the government in response to demands by the International Monetary Fund, or IMF. A center-left politician from Argentina's long-dominant Peronist party, Kirchner was sworn in as Argentina's 52nd president amid promises to defend domestic jobs and industry after more than a decade of unbridled free market policies. But he also faces challenges, restoring Argentina's ties to the international investment community and guiding his country out of its worst economic decline in history. Over the last 5 years, Argentina, a country that previously enjoyed the highest living standards in Latin America, has suffered through the worst economic decline in its history. A majority of people now live below the poverty line, and unemployment rests at 22%. Kirchner, from the sparsely populated Patagonian province of Santa Cruz, won his four-year presidential term by default after former President Carlos Menem dropped out of a runoff election. Menem decided to abandon the electoral race despite winning its initial round after opinion polls showed him losing by more than a 2-to-1 margin in a runoff contest against Kirchner. Menem was Argentina's president from 1991 to 1999, and although he left office before the country's economy collapsed, voters hold him largely responsible for the depression. A majority of voters in the first round of the election had voted for other candidates, including Kirchner, who rejected Menem's economic policies. Nonetheless, Kirchner comes to power after receiving only 16% of the popular vote in a preliminary election. Under Menem's leadership, Argentina had experimented with an extreme version of neoliberalism, fostering the indiscriminate opening of the country's markets to foreign capital and trade, launching the large-scale privatization of public companies and services, and implementing a currency system that fixed Argentina's peso to the U.S. dollar. Despite initial success in taming inflation and boosting economic growth, these policies made Argentina extremely vulnerable to external fluctuations in the global economy. Ripples created after the U.S. Federal Reserve started a series of interest rate hikes in 1994, followed by the Mexican peso crisis in 95 and the Asian, Russian, and Brazilian financial crises in the later years of the 90s, each sent shockwaves through the Argentine economy, which could not adjust so long as its currency was tied to the U.S. dollar and its economy was dependent on foreign investment. The result was a vicious spiral. Private capital flight by foreign investors led to increasing interest rates and a shrinking economy in Argentina, which led to more debt and even higher interest rates as investors feared currency devaluation and then debt default. The government finally did default on $95 billion worth of public debt at the end of 2000. 1 year later, the currency collapsed to one quarter its former value as banks from around the world pulled remaining investments out of the country and mass civil unrest accompanied worsening poverty. Despite the deepening crisis, the IMF continued to support Argentina's open market policies. Fund officials prolonged and worsened the depression by insisting on monetary and fiscal austerity measures at inappropriate times. All indications are that the IMF will now pressure Argentina's government to run large budget surpluses in order to make payments on its defaulted debts. This and other traditional IMF policy prescriptions could easily choke off the economy's nascent economic recovery. Since Argentina devalued its currency 1 year ago, the peso has risen more than 20% against the sinking U.S. dollar. As yet, Kirchner has been reluctant to meet with IMF officials, but Argentina's agreement with the International Money Lending Institution will expire in August, so negotiations will have to begin soon. Observers are unsure how Kirchner will respond to the pressures of the IMF and the international investment community. As a three-term governor of the sparsely populated Santa Cruz province, Kirchner's leadership skills are largely untested on the national and international stages. The new president certainly has a mandate to resist IMF demands and make economic recovery the country's first priority. But so far, his economic policy initiatives have been vague. To jumpstart the domestic economy and increase employment, Kirchner has promised a multi-billion-dollar public works program and a long-term rescheduling of the government's debt. Whether this plan will be accepted by international creditors is another question. Kirchner has already antagonized the American investment community by criticizing U.S. policies on free trade, the embargo on Cuba, and the war in Iraq. On the other hand, the devaluation of the Argentine peso, accompanied by apparent economic recovery and a booming tourism sector, has made Argentina a tempting haven for other foreign investors who are snapping up inexpensive property in the country. When and if the economy recovers, a great deal of property and industry could remain in foreign hands. Kirchner took his oath of office on Sunday before Congress in Buenos Aires. His wife, Senator Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner, and their two children attended the inauguration ceremony alongside regional leaders including Cuba's Fidel Castro, Brazil's Lula da Silva, and Venezuela's Hugo Chavez. As many as 400 million workers representing both organized and unorganized labor in the public and private sectors participated in a national strike against the government of India's neoliberal economic policies last Wednesday. The strike was called by a coalition of India's most prominent trade unions, calling for a halt to the government's privatization schemes and plans to reform labor laws. The government's privatization projects aim to raise 132 billion rupees, or about $3 billion, by selling off state-run companies before March 2004. Proposed labor reforms being introduced at the same time include allowing state-run companies to dismiss workers and reducing deposit rates for pension funds. The government says that privatization is necessary to bridge India's increasing fiscal deficit and claims that labor reforms are needed to allow Indian industry to compete with countries such as China. The privatization and labor reform schemes are being promoted by the IMF and the World Bank as a way out of debt for India's government. Workers argue that the plans will lead to huge job losses and an end to job security in both the public and private sectors. The protest demands included halting the privatization of profit-making public sector businesses, cutting foreign direct investment in all service sectors, enacting comprehensive legislation to protect agricultural workers, maintaining the status quo on labor laws, and broadening social security. The strike affected banking, insurance, telecom, transportation, postal services, and mining operations across the country. Public services were particularly affected. Nationalized banks and post offices closed for the day. Work was also suspended in electricity and public health departments. Protesters organized rail and road blockades in various parts of the country while holding demonstrations and rallies. Calcutta was brought to a virtual standstill as protesters marched through the streets. The strike was described as the biggest show of discontent in recent times against the central government's economic policies. Germany's most powerful unions also staged a nationwide strike last week to protest the government's plans to trim unemployment benefits and loosen job protection. As many as 90,000 workers marched in 14 cities across the country Saturday to protest Chancellor Gerhard Schröder's proposed reforms. Agenda 2010, announced in March, is Schröder's response to a German economy on the verge of recession, with a rising budget deficit and unemployment close to 11%. As the German government's budget looks toward a 15 billion euro deficit in 2004, Schröder argues that costly social programs will have to be trimmed to ensure the long-term survival of Germany's welfare state. But there are other reasons for the dwindling reserves in Germany's federal coffers. Tax cuts introduced by Finance Minister Hans Eichel slashed government revenues from corporate taxes by 23 billion euros in 2000 to virtually nothing in 2001. Postmen, nurses, and bus drivers in Germany now pay more tax than Daimler Chrysler does on its profits. Agenda 2010 marks the most severe budget cuts to be introduced by a German government since the Second World War. Cuts to public welfare include shortening the period of payments for unemployment insurance and consolidating different forms of benefits, drastically cutting access to health insurance, transferring the costs of health care onto the shoulders of working people and the sick. Critics say the program, combined with recent tax cuts, represents a massive redistribution of wealth from the hands of working people to the profit margins of big business. But mobilizing labor against these initiatives has been slow, particularly among unions tied to the private sector. Many participants in last weekend's rallies expressed disillusionment with their unions, some of which have officially urged collaboration with the government on developing cuts to social services. And lastly, the United Nations sell-off of the Kosovan Protectorate has begun as the UN publishes tenders for the controversial privatization of almost 500 formerly publicly owned companies in the region. Serbia, of which the Kosovan Protectorate is still legally a part, has opposed the privatizations. Kosovan trade unions have also opposed the sales. Kosovo became a UN protectorate in June of 1999 after an 11-week bombing campaign by NATO led to a Serbian withdrawal. According to the Kosovo Trust Agency, a UN body, the interim administration has introduced laws to, quote, ensure a very investor-friendly environment, including regulations on foreign investment, repatriation of capital, the purchase of real estate, and 99-year leases of land formerly used by socially owned enterprises, end quote. The UN claims that the sell-offs are vital for kickstarting Kosovo's economy, where about 2 million inhabitants depend mainly on foreign aid. But the head of Serbia's Coordinating Center for Kosovo has denounced the leases, claiming Belgrade was not consulted about their introduction. The Serbian government is particularly concerned about $1.4 billion in foreign debt it has guaranteed that is owed by the Kosovan companies. Despite being promised 20% of the privatization proceeds, unions representing workers at the companies have also opposed the sales. The Ombudsman for Kosovo, an independent arbitrator for human rights issues, expects appeals against the privatizations to be filed. And that's a wrap for this week's Business Report. Signing off, this is Andy Beasneys reminding you to put your money where your mouth is and invest ethically.
And that was this week's Auntie Beasneys Report coming to us from CKLN Radio in Toronto, Canada. My name is V-Man. This is Rockin' the Boat. In just a moment, Reese Ehrlich will be joining us for a discussion of Iran. Stay tuned.
Well, old Adam Smith, he gave us this myth about how the market will self-regulate. But elite business schemes would still just be dreams without the arms of the state. If you wanna know what they mean when they say we're gonna open up your markets for our free trade, just ask the ghosts of all those who've been killed for refusing to bow down before the dollar bill.
Since the fall of Baghdad to U.S. Marines on April 9th, U.S. media pundits have stepped up the rhetoric and have been postulating about who might be next on Washington's hit list for regime change. Will it be Syria? Lebanon? North Korea? Much of the speculation has been centered on Iran, Iraq's eastern neighbor and member of the Axis of Evil. Meanwhile, the CIA is investigating itself and other agencies to see if pre-war reports of Iraqi weapons of mass destruction and ties to al-Qaeda were misused by Bush administration officials. Now, allegations have surfaced that the Iranian government has violated an international agreement not to produce nuclear weapons. Today, we'll discuss the possibilities with Reese Ehrlich, a veteran, independent, foreign news correspondent. He is the producer of a one-hour public radio special, The Struggle for Iran, which is hosted by Walter Cronkite. Reese Ehrlich is also co-author of the book Target Iraq, What the News Media Didn't Tell You. Thanks for joining me today here on Rockin' the Boat, Reese Ehrlich.
Thanks very much, Vinny.
Reese, let's start. Let me ask you here. Most Americans remember the Iran hostage crisis in 1979 when 52 Americans were taken hostage, but American intervention in Iran goes back to a much earlier period. In 1953, after Mohammad Mossadegh, the popular leader in Iran, nationalized their oil fields, he was deposed by a CIA-orchestrated coup. Can you paint us a portrait about this coup and how life has changed for ordinary Iranians under the Ayatollah Khomeini?
Sure. Well, the thing to keep in mind is that this whole idea that the U.S. can impose regime change on other countries is nothing new. The U.S., the rhetoric and the reason for doing it has changed over the years, but the basic idea that the U.S., some god has anointed the U.S. the power to overthrow governments in other parts of the world and install governments to its liking, that's been going on for a long time. And if specifically in the case of Iran, in Iran, of course, like Iraq, has a vast oil supplies. The democratically elected prime minister of Iran, Mohammad Mossadegh, was decided to nationalize the Iranian oil, and that meant the taking over the, at that time, was British petroleum and British oil companies that were the dominant factor in Iran. And, of course, that was tantamount to communism, and he was called a communist, and at that time, the bugaboo wasn't terrorism, it was communism. And Mossadegh was not a communist. There was a communist party in Iran, the Tudeh party, but it had nothing to do with Mossadegh. He had his own nationalist party. And so the U.S. Orchestrated a campaign and portrayed him as a weak man. And probably the most telling in our documentary, the most telling, we did a story about the media coverage of the Iran overthrow of Mossadegh and down through the years. And there's this great newsreel footage where, you know, very swelling of music, and says, "Now with Mossadegh gone, Iranian oil will flow westward once again." So it tells you a lot of what that one was all about. So the U.S. Directly at that time installed the Reza Shah dynasty in power, and he ruled as a horrible dictator for the following 26 years until 1979. And then in 1979, of course, the popular revolution took place that was supported by the left, by Muslim groups, by conservative groups, all kinds of people who had been oppressed under the Shah. And there was tremendous joy in Iran with the overthrow of the Shah and the kicking out of the U.S. as the dominant, by that time, the dominant power. The problem was is that these extremely conservative right-wing clerics managed to seize control of the Iranian revolution and impose a theocracy on the country. And it's become a horrible dictatorship all over again, albeit with a Muslim facade to it rather than a pro-U.S. Facade to it. But the Iranian people, in elections, in popular demonstrations, in all kinds of ways, have shown their discontent with the with the government there. But now the U.S. is suddenly, you know, we're seeing the same rhetoric all over again as we saw with Iraq. In fact, they're using the exact same lies. Yeah. Oh, they're supporting terrorism. Oh, they've got nuclear weapons. Oh, blah, 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 blah. We've got to, you know, the next step is to say, oh, well, we've got to go in and affect regime change, and the wonderful Iranian people will love us all over again.
Can I step back for a moment and ask you to talk a little bit more about the rejection of modernization by the people there, and give us a sense of how the people in Iran feel about this rise of this conservative Islamist rule, as you've described?
Well, it's complicated. I don't think they reject modernization. You know, you can go to Iran and see computers and internet cafes and you know, modern technology all over the place. Their oil industry is very modern. So it's not a rejection of modernization. It's a rejection of what they see as Western ways. And what makes it tricky is that encompasses everything from U.S. economic domination, which certainly is a legitimate concern of any third world country, but it also means the oppression of women, the banning of alcohol, the suppression of newspapers, television and film. It's a very theocratic, conservative interpretation of Islam. And frankly, most Iranians, as indicated by the elections, are fed up with that. They're not fed up with Islam or even the idea of an Islamic state, but they're very much upset with and oppose the right-wing theocrats who in essence run the country through the military, the police, and the courts. The religious institutions. All kinds of democratic reforms have been voted on and approved of, and then they're just overturned by the clerics, who are the real power in the country. So people have not, I mean, there's obviously lots of difference of opinion in Iran, but they certainly do, the majority of people do not like the hardline clerics who are running the country.
Okay. We're speaking with Rhys Ehrlich. He's a veteran independent foreign news correspondent and a producer of the one-hour public radio special, The Struggle for Iran, and co-author of the recent book, Target Iraq, What the News Media Didn't Tell You. Rhys, responding to a question about Iran's pursuit of al-Qaeda remnants alleged to be hiding there, White House Press Secretary Ari Fleischer today said, quote, we are pressing the Iranians to end their support for terror, including the harboring of Al-Qaeda terrorists. Our policy on Iran remains that the future of Iran is to be determined by the Iranian people. He went on to say that the U.S. will use diplomatic means, but what do you think about what's coming out of the White House?
Well, it's rather hypocritical coming out of the White House, since they don't believe that the people of Florida should determine the votes in Florida. Why the heck should we believe them when they talk about supporting the people of Iran? You have to, again, for anybody who knows anything about the region, it's a complete joke. The Iranian government was very much opposed to the Taliban and to Al-Qaeda. They represent different groups within Islam. That is, the leaders in Iran are Shia Muslims. The Taliban and the Al-Qaeda are Sunni Muslims. The Taliban government invaded a Iranian consulate back when the Taliban was in power and killed a bunch of Iranian diplomats. I mean, it was very serious. The Iranians had their own anti-Taliban guerrilla forces that they backed in the war against Afghanistan. So the idea that somehow Al-Qaeda and Iran have made a conscious link-up and that the Iranian government is sponsoring Al-Qaeda, I mean, it's just absurd for anybody who knows anything about the history of the area. Now, is it possible that some Al-Qaeda people have escaped from Iran, from Afghanistan into Iran, and are seeking refuge? That's possible, but that doesn't mean that they're being supported by the Iranian government.
What about the issue of the alleged nuclear weapons program? Looking at an article in today's Mercury News, it was written by Cheryl Gates Stolberg of the New York Times. She writes, administration officials are now trying to build international support for an official finding from the International Atomic Energy Agency. And it goes on to say that board is meeting in June at its headquarters. What do you make of these accusations?
Well, you know, I don't have any independent information that says they do or do not have nuclear weapons. The Iranians say steadfastly they do not have nuclear weapons, that they have a peaceful program to develop nuclear power. I say show me the money. You know, the U.S. claims that they made the same claims about Iraq, and turned out that all of their claims were based on blatantly forged documents. So I don't believe any of the documents or any of the intelligence that the U.S. Circulates. Iran is part of the International Atomic Energy Commission protocols. The international agency can send inspectors in. I would trust a fair evaluation by an international body that's not dominated by the United States. But right now, the Bush administration has a rather poor record on accusing others of harboring nuclear weapons, when of course it's got the largest nuclear arsenal and the largest number of weapons of mass destruction in the entire history of the world.
Let's talk a little bit about the media, Reese. You're the author of Target Iraq, What the News Media Didn't Tell You. This article that I just cited really doesn't give much depth or background to the situation. And conversely, I read an article in today's, I think it was The Observer in the UK, and it was about a similar story, but it gave much more in-depth like analysis and discussion of what's going on in Iraq's government, how it's sort of in chaos. As you mentioned, there's a reformist movement within the council there in Iran. What do you think about the coverage, here in the U.S. of this issue?
Well, it depends on the day that you check the papers. The New York Times and other media in the U.S. have run in-depth articles about Iran at various times in the past. I've interacted with a number of New York Times and other mainstream reporters who've reported from Iran, CNN and others, and they're not stupid. They're aware of the contradictions that are going on in Iran. The biggest problem is that the U.S. media's starting point is whatever hype is coming out of the White House and the Pentagon at the moment. That's the beginning of the story. And that they, as one New York Times reporter told me in a moment of confidence, she said, hey, I've never met a New York Times reporter who would believe that a U.S. government official would lie to them. Basically, they think that whoever's in power, it's not just the Bush administration, it was true during Clinton and previous administrations, that they are so hooked into the system, their lives, their professional careers, ideologically, every other way, they are so hooked into the system that they actually believe this hokum that is spoon-fed out on a regular basis. So if your starting point is the false assumptions of who's ever in power in the United States, then of course your article is going to end up being rather distorted by the time it's finished being written.
Reese, we just have a few moments left. Maybe we can finish on maybe if you can give us some prospects for a true democracy and peace in the region, and what those prospects are now that the U.S. seems to have a pretty huge military presence right next door in Iraq.
Well, it's a very, very dangerous situation. You know, the U.S. has expanded its power. It surrounds Iran both from the side of Afghanistan and from the side of Iraq. It's now in a position, you know, the U.S. has announced it's going to have 4 military bases in Iraq. It's, you know, now a direct, quite the contrary of somehow making the U.S. safer from terrorism. The U.S. is just spreading the anger at U.S. policy and recruiting more people to terrorism by its actions. Not to mention people who are righteously angry at U.S. military and economic policy. I think the Bush administration, the one thing that is encouraging to me is that the Bush administration has way, way overestimated its ability to control Iraq, and we can see it by the horrible deaths of American soldiers in the last couple of days. Iraq is in chaos. The U.S. is incapable of establishing a government there. It can't even get the electricity turned back on. The U.S. is not going to be able to go around invading other countries willy-nilly when it can't even bring stability to Iraq. And if that situation, along with a bad economy, continues into next year, we may well see regime change not in Tehran but in Washington, D.C.
Well, one can only hope. With the way the last election turned out, though, I have my doubts.
Well, get me back on the show. We'll talk some more.
All right, great. We've been speaking with Reese Ehrlich, veteran independent foreign news correspondent, producer of the one-hour public radio special, The Struggle for Iran, and also he's co-author of the book with Norman Solomon called Target Iraq, What the News Media Didn't Tell You. That is available from your local independent bookseller. And we thank you, Reese, for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
All right, and you have a great day.
Bye-bye.
Bye. And this is Rockin' the Boat. My name is the V-Man, and we're going to sign off right now. Tomorrow, hopefully, I'll be talking about the FCC hearings coming up next week and the possibility of a rally happening at the Federal Building in San Francisco this Thursday night. And coming up on Thursday night on the program at 5:30, I'll be joined by Michael Parenti, noted author of more than 15 books. We'll be discussing more of what the U.S. is doing in the world. Stand by, stay tuned. The Hobo Music Show's up next here on Free Radio Santa Cruz,